You are listening to the Health and Wellness Connection Podcast, the number one wellness podcast designed to provide the latest information to help you achieve your health and wellness goals. Our show features exciting guests, the latest in medical research, and in-depth discussions in current trends on weight loss, nutrition, and fitness. No matter what your interest, the Health and Wellness Podcast has you covered. And now, presenting your illustrious host, Dr. Barry, MD.
Hello, 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 and welcome back to the Health and Wellness Connection. It's your host, Dr. Barry, here, and I want to thank you for joining us for another episode of this Health and Wellness Focus Show. Now, of course, we hear every few weeks, and we try to drop some pertinent health knowledge. Ideally, we like to focus on the health topics that are really breaking out in the news, but if you have any certain topics you want us to discuss, definitely feel free to shoot us an email. We will definitely take a look and see whether or not it's something that fits the the topics of our show. So with that being said, we can be reached at Instagram, Dr. Barry MD on Instagram. Also email drbarryhealth@gmail.com, and also TikTok at Dr. Barry Health on TikTok. So yes, if you want to reach out, you can follow us on those platforms, send us that message. We will get those. Also, we're up for email as well. So drbarryhealth@gmail.com. So awesome, guys. So we are broadcasting live from Houston, Texas this week, and we're just kind of talking about some of the latest things we're seeing on the wire. So let's jump into some of the more pertinent health topics that we've come across, and we'll see, what to make of those when we break them down for our listeners. All right, guys. So the first topic that I want to discuss is a kind of a concerning one, as it involves some concerning cancer-causing agents found in common household products. So a new report came out looking at some of the popular acne skin treatments, lotions, and other items that are sold by many cosmetic and beauty supply manufacturers, including Estee Lauder, their Clinique brand, Target, Up and Up. You got the Clearasil also, which is owned by independent U.S. laboratory, Valisure. And so what's going on is FDA has identified these products as containing dangerously high levels of a carcinogen known as benzene. So benzene is something that has been detected to be a carcinogen and is, not supposed to be available for human consumption. Now, benzene has been found in various, dangerous areas. But now it's being seen that various products that have a chemical that was known as benzoyl peroxide actually turns into benzene and forms high concentration of the carcinogen when put on the skin. So anything that's used to treat acne, particularly with benzoyl peroxide, apparently converts to benzene and forms very high levels in both the over-the-counter and prescription version of these medications. So this is pretty concerning because benzoyl peroxide is a very commonly used ingredient for many anti-acne lotions and face washes. It's believed that benzoyl peroxide is effective in clearing bacteria that's on the skin. However, it's now seen that this benzene that's being produced from this benzoyl peroxide is extremely carcinogenic and can cause all kinds of cancers. Now, this is very concerning because this is found in many, many skin preparations, including sunscreens, hand sanitizers, dry shampoo, and other items. So this is, if you look on your store shelves, benzoyl peroxide is a very popular ingredient. So now we're seeing that this benzoyl peroxide may convert to benzene, which is a very well-known carcinogen and can be very dangerous if exposed to for extended periods. This new finding is leading to FDA to recall a lot of these over-the-counter preparations to help remove these potentially toxic creams and preparations from the human public. Now, so just because, it looks good and has a very slick marketing campaign, does that mean it's safe? My opinion, I do like, personally, black soap is actually what I actually recommend people use to wash their face, only because of the charcoal, which is great for absorbing impurities. And of course, the shea butter component is great for moisturization. ultimately, there are many different preparations out there that are effective for acne prevention and cleaning one's face. But anything with benzoyl peroxide potentially could be a carcinogen, should be avoided, according to the latest report from the FDA. So this is concerning, guys. Hopefully you guys are clearing your bathroom shelves of any potential face cleansers, acne treatment preparations that are contain this ingredient. I'll advise you to look, anything you're putting on your face or your body for that matter, look and see if it has this benzoyl peroxide. If it does, it's probably not safe to continue using. And we've always assumed that a lot of these chemicals that are being pushed have a lot of chemicals and ingredients that are not really tested. So this report is very concerning, and I encourage everyone who has similar preparations in their bathrooms and their, you know, beauty routines to reassess what they're using and potentially remove anything that may have this ingredient. So of course we'll give you more information as we get it, but yes, this is the latest report from the FDA. Benzoyl peroxide may be linked to benzene, which is a carcinogen, and should be avoided going forward. All right, guys, so moving on, another carcinogen which we've talked about here on this show in the past includes those forever chemicals that are derived from plastics. Well, another report is showing that plastics produce small micro compounds known as nanoplastics. These are, I mean, extremely microscopic. You cannot see them with the normal naked eye. And these things apparently are being, you know, excreted or sloughed off from plastic containers and are, in fact, contaminating various foods and other preparations that are usually housed with these plastics, and are actually potentially dangerous in that they are causing inflammation in the blood cells and blood vessels of various people, causing increased risk of cancer. So the latest research is showing that these nanoplastics or microplastics are actually getting into the cells and different structures within our body, and they're actually forming areas of inflammation that cause increased inflammation and damage to the cells of various parts of the body. Now, one thing that was actually done with this particular study, and what they did was that, and actually before I'm going to what they did, let's talk about the people who did the research, because it's very important. First off, it was published in the New England Journal of Medicine, so a very prominent journal, probably the most prominent. And what they did was, this study was actually done in Italy, University of Campania Luigi Vanvitelli, and the actual head researcher was Dr. Marfella. And what happened is they actually went into various people who had a procedure known as a carotid endarterectomy. Essentially, what a carotid endarterectomy is the carotid arteries, which are the big arteries in your neck, they can get clogged up over time with debris, inflammation, fat, cholesterol. But also they're seeing now that actual microplastics are also stuck inside the blood vessels in one's neck, causing inflammation and overall damage to the blood vessel, leading to obstruction. This, of course, can lead to strokes and cell damage if this happens anywhere. Imagine if it happens in the blood vessel in your heart. You get inflammation and you get obstruction. Therefore, you end up getting a heart attack. So this is very serious, guys. And these microplastics potentially are causing this. How do we know? Well, what they did was, during the procedure where they're going into people's necks who have been documented to have an obstruction, they're actually going in there to clean them out. And what they do is essentially go into the vessel, essentially scrape out all the debris on the vessel walls, opening up those blood vessels for proper blood flow. Then they took that debris and analyzed it under a microscope to see what was actually in them. And you'll be shocked what they found, guys. They found all kinds of microplastic molecules. They even found chlorine. They found all kinds of byproducts of PVC, all kinds of inorganic chemicals that were being deposited in the blood vessels of these people. And around these plastics were a lot of inflammation, debris, and other responses, most likely from the body trying to isolate and fight those deposits that are not natural. So it just shows that the body is, you know, having a very horrific reaction to some of these chemicals and plastics we're exposed to on a daily basis, and could explain the rise in cancer in so-called developed nations, because these nations are very well known to depend on plastics for packaging and other regular use. So And again, this is very scary because microplastics are something that cannot be seen with the human eye. They range from anywhere from less than 0.2 inches down to 1/25,000th of an inch, or 1 micrometer. So this is something you cannot really perceive, but when ingested, can cause very significant damage, especially over the long term. Because again, these plastics are invading the individual cells and tissues of major organs, interrupting cellular processes and depositing endocrine disrupting chemicals into the skin tissue. And we've talked about phthalates in the past. You also have all kinds of heavy metals, polyfluorinated substances and the like. So this is very concerning, guys. I'm sure you guys have been hearing me talk about avoiding plastics. You don't want to be reheating plastics. Ideally, if you want to have a container for storage, glass, stainless steel are still obviously the best options as far as the lack of things leaching into whatever you're storing. So while plastics are very, you know, helpful, I'm not saying eliminate plastics. Plastics are very useful for many different industries, many different ways to help store items and other industrial uses. But when it comes to food storage and preparation, it may not be very safe to keep them long term in plastics. So yes, this is to me a very concerning development. Nanoplastics, again, are extremely prevalent because of the extreme prevalence of plastic containers. And just to show you the power of how much these microplastics and nanoplastics are in our various food and water supplies, a recent study looked at 1 liter bottled water, right? And they looked at to see how much nanoplastics were in it. They found over 240,000 plastic particles from 7 types of plastics in this water bottle. Again, this is not perceived by the human eye. So that's what even makes it more concerning. So imagine you're drinking a bottle of water in a plastic bottle, thinking all is well. Meanwhile, there are hundreds of thousands of microparticles that are potentially harmful to you that you're also ingesting. So yeah, this is pretty concerning, guys. And it's just because this is thing, I like this kind of studies because they look at the actual tissue and they're seeing things that are not natural to the human body. And because we know that things like nanoplastics and things are very new, it could be part of the reason why we see this uptick in cancer rates that we're seeing every year due to the prevalence of these plastics in our society. So ultimately, this I think is a wake-up call and the continued information that we're putting out there regarding plastics and its dangers, especially when it comes to cancer-causing potential. We should definitely take a closer look at how we're using our plastics, how we're storing our plastics. I personally am focused on eliminating plastics from anything that I consume. So I'm storing things in glass, stainless steel, things like that, and just using plastics for industrial things, you know, for things you're building, you know, in the industry, in the work site, plastics can be very effective. Helmets are very important, made of plastic. So I'm not saying eliminate all plastics, but definitely when it comes to consumption, you want to be careful how you're using it to store things that you'll be consuming. All right, guys, a new report on obesity has come out. And yes, the numbers are looking worse and worse, guys. Seems like there are over now 1 billion people around the world that are obese. This is out of a world population of about 7.88 billion. So almost 1 in 8 people are now obese worldwide. So, it's something that we have to really look at very closely because obesity, we've talked about endlessly on this show, is linked to so many different illnesses, cancer, heart disease, stroke, and going on and on as far as the potential increased risk of death. So obesity is now extremely prevalent and it's getting more so. Let's talk about some of the numbers, right? So this report comes from WHO. It looked at, you know, obesity rates and kind of comparing them to many years back. They started from 1990 to up to 2022 when the study concluded. And they found that obesity rates have nearly quadrupled amongst children and adolescents between the years 1990 and 2022. And they've actually tripled amongst adult men and more than doubled amongst women during that same time period. Again, 1990 to 2022. So, yes, obesity is rising outrageously and it's moving at a rate that's really unsustainable. I think it's very important that obesity be looked at as a medical illness and we can start doing everything we can to ensure that the numbers don't continue to go up. So this study, let's talk about some of the details. Looked at about 3,663 population-based studies. So they looked at different studies that studied obesity. So this is what we call a meta-analysis. They didn't actually look at the people directly. They actually looked at other studies that actually already assessed this. They looked at the trends and seen how the rates of obesity were being recorded and measured throughout these periods over these various groups. They looked at the BMI as far as how obesity levels were being assessed. And BMI is effective, and it's a good tool to use when looking at groups of people, not necessarily individual people, because it has a lot of things that can throw it off. But as a group, like a group of people, like over a certain number, BMI can be a great way to track the level of obesity. So what they found was that, again, obesity was increasing at levels that were really not believed prior to this kind of data being released. So ultimately, you know, obesity is something that we have to really take seriously, guys. I'm someone who believes that, you know, if you're treating obesity, you're going to actually at the same time treat other very chronic illnesses that are also plaguing the population, including high blood pressure, high cholesterol, heart disease, stroke risk, and the like. So obesity is something we have to take seriously, guys. And then we have tons of data on this show regarding how to look at obesity and how to treat it, from calorie counting to weight management to exercise management and the like. So please, guys, I encourage you, if you have not already, go through the archives, check out some of the previous shows we've done. Everything's on our podcast website. If you just Google Health is Wealth Wellness, and you can see a lot of our shows that we've done over the past few years, and listen to something that may, you know, give you some insight to help you address obesity if you're one of the billion people who now suffer from the condition. Okay, guys, so let's talk about another study that I came across that I was pretty concerned about. And it's about artificially sweetened drinks. So artificial sweeteners is something we actually have talked about ad nauseum on this show as well, about it just not ideal. A lot of things have come out regarding artificial sweeteners that are concerning, including increased risk of cancer and other potential medical issues. Now, it looks like another report is linking artificial sweeteners to increased risk of atrial fibrillation. Atrial fibrillation is a very concerning heart condition that can actually result in your heart beating at irregular rhythms. So beating not smooth and consistent like it's supposed to is beating off rhythm, which can throw off everything, really. It can lead to clot formation in your heart, can lead to strokes and other potential badness. So you don't want atrial fibrillation. It's not something that is ideal for a long life. So what happened is this study looked at sugar sweetened beverages, artificially sweetened beverages that were being consumed by participants in the study. And the study looked at was over 200,000 people. This is via the UK Biobank, which is a huge database of people who go to the hospital in the UK system. And they look at all their data, how much did they self-report as far as consuming beverages with artificial sweeteners. And they looked at those particularly who consumed over 2 liters a week of artificially sweetened beverages, right? And so what they did was follow these people over the span of 10 years, and they found that out of the 200,000 people who were studied, 9,300 were documented to have developed atrial fibrillation. And what they found was that those who consumed artificially sweetened beverages, again, artificially sweetened beverages, things that have used artificial sweeteners like like aspartame, NutraSweet, Sweet and Low, Sucralose, Saccharin, Xylitol. There's a few of them that are pretty popular, but those are some of the main ones. And they found that those who drank beverages that had these sweeteners in them had a 20% increased risk of developing atrial fibrillation compared to those who did not. So 20% is a pretty significant jump, guys. So I think drinking these artificially sweetened beverages, if there weren't enough reasons to stop already, this is just another reason. So atrial fibrillation is something you don't really want, very dangerous, and it's not something that's compatible with long life. So I would say if you're potentially someone who drinks these beverages or beverages with artificial sweeteners in them, it's better you just avoid the sugar or use lower amounts of natural sugar. Again, natural sugar is still the best sweetener. You can also use honey as well. I'm a big fan of honey as a sweetener. Ideally, you want natural organic honey because that actually has a lot of other benefiting ingredients, including energy boosting ingredients and other you know, anti-cancer causing ingredients as well. So, you know, avoid artificial sweeteners, choose sugar, natural honey and the like, because again, those artificial sweeteners have just a lot of negative side effects that we're seeing more and more of every day. All right, guys, so another study regarding cannabis and cardiovascular risk has come across the desk. So let's talk about that as well. So cannabis is something that is used quite a bit for many different medical and non-medical reasons. Big use, including anxiety, other potential uses, including some people use it for depression, and other people use it for simply enjoyment. And so cannabis has been reported to be relatively safe compared to other things on the market. However, it's definitely not without risks. Now, a new study is coming out that's showing that the use of cannabis has been associated with a increased risk of adverse cardiovascular outcomes. And this is now independent of tobacco, according to the study. So they looked at people. Again, first off, we always have the details. This study came out from the University of California, San Francisco. So that is a place where cannabis is fairly legal. And many users are there. So they can have a nice space to study from. This is Dr. Kayani Saloma, MD, and this was published in the Journal of the American Heart Association. So what they found was that they looked at people who they monitored between 2016 and 2020. And this is about 430,000 people between the ages of 18 to 74. So it was a pretty good amount of people, and this was a survey. So people submitted, they respond to a survey where they self-reported details about their use and so forth. So then what they did was ask people about their use of cannabis and the number of days that they used cannabis in the past 30 days. Then they looked and see if they also asked them if they had cardiovascular disease or heart attack or experienced similar issues in the past. And they found that 4% of respondents used cannabis daily, right? And 7.1% reported non-daily use. And so what they found was that those who smoked cannabis, after adjusting for age, sex, race, and ethnicity, they found out there was a strong link between those who had been reporting daily cannabis use and those who had cardiovascular events, including stroke, heart attack, or other similar events. So, which is a pretty significant. This is all self-reported. So they ask people, hey, look, guys, have you been smoking? How often do you smoke? Okay, then they ask them later, have you had a heart attack, or are you at risk for having a heart attack? Well, they asked them, had they had a heart attack, excuse me. And they found that there was a significant increase in those who had smoked regularly who actually had heart-related events. Now, it's believed that some people argue that potentially the smoking is really more of a concern as opposed to the actual cannabis, because tobacco smokers also have a very similar increased risk of these same issues. However, the study organizers believe that edibles may be a safer way to consume cannabis, but smoking is linked to a lot of these potential toxins that are produced that are potentially harmful to the cardiovascular system. So ultimately, this study was, again, very informal. It was like more of a survey, so they can actually look at people and follow them closely. So I think it's something that can open the door for more investigation into this. This is really conclude anything definitively, but I think that because we're seeing a potential association more so with the smoking, I think this definitely deserves more research. So if you do have a heart condition, you know, you want to kind of reevaluate if you're considering using cannabis for anything, be it recreational or medical, that you talk with your doctor and figure out a safe way to consume. And so just follow this. We'll be following this as well, guys. So just make sure that, you know, if you are a smoker, you have heart problems, talk to your doctor. And if you are someone who is smoking and worried about your heart, talk to your doctor. At the end of the day, though, smoking itself is harmful, so you want to refrain from smoking if you can. Vaping may be a little bit less harmful, but edibles may be the safest way, but also not completely free of risk. So just talk to your doc and do what's best for your health. Okay, guys, so new data on fiber. You know, I'm a big fan of fiber. I'm all about a high fiber diet, whole grains, low carbs. That's probably the best way to lose weight. And a new study is coming out showing that high fiber has been associated with improved insulin sensitivity, which is what you want if you want to have better weight control, and also improve with reducing excess body weight, because there's apparently a change in the gut microbia that is noticeable when your fiber intake increases. So again, this study looked at animals to kind of determine, you know, whether or not this was something that was something to be looked at. And they found that those who were increasing their dietary fiber, they were found to have improved weight loss and improved insulin sensitivity. Two things we really want. And they looked at folks, you know, this is actually a pretty small study. Only 37 people were involved, but there were individuals who were overweight, meaning a BMI greater than 24, and they were feeding them a similar diet, right? And they gave them, one group had a high fiber diet, another group had a regular placebo diet, mostly starch. And what they did was they looked at folks, fed them for about 8 weeks. Then they looked at different more, intimate components. They looked at their subcutaneous fat mass, their waist circumference, their lipid profiles, their insulin sensitivity levels, and also their gut microbiome. So they took some stool, looked at what bacteria was in their stool, comparing those who ate high fiber diets to those who did not. And they showed that those who had the high fiber diets, first off, they lost more weight, about 3 kilograms or about 6 point something pounds over the 8 week period were lost. Those who had high fiber, those who had placebo, a lot of starches, they didn't really lose any weight or change weight really. And those who had the high fiber also had improved insulin sensitivity. So they were able to respond better to insulin, meaning their blood sugars dropped quicker after consuming sugars. They had lower overall blood sugars as well. And lastly, those who had the high levels of fiber had increased levels of a gut microbe known as Bifidobacterium adolescentis, which is actually one of the bacteria that's apparently helpful in improving digestion as well as reducing obesity. So they also found lower levels of pro-inflammatory cytokines, all these inflammatory mediators that can actually cause cancer, cause cell damage, including tumor necrosis factor alpha, interleukin 1 beta. Again, we're getting pretty into the nuts and bolts of physiology here, but ultimately more inflammation is kind of the bottom line. Those who had high fiber diets, had less inflammation. So when you add a lot of fiber, you have improved bacteria in your gut, you have less inflammatory cells, less inflammatory chemicals, and just overall improved health, better weight loss and everything else. So high fiber is critical. And best fiber source include beans, fruits and vegetables, things that are natural source of fiber. If you don't get enough fiber naturally, taking supplements is definitely a good idea. I'm a big fan of psyllium husks. Those are great fiber supplements for those who are not getting enough fiber, but you want to get it in your food, your vegetables, things like that. So high fiber, very important for overall health. And now we're seeing it's improved. The body is it does much better with high fiber diet. And we see that with improved levels of weight maintenance, improved insulin sensitivity, as well as better gut microbes that are ideal for weight maintenance and weight loss. All right, guys. So another study is out here. We're looking at herpes and dementia. You never thought you would hear that combination together, did you? Well, apparently herpes may be linked to increased risk of developing dementia. And this is the oral herpes, the kissing one, the type one, not the type two, which is more genitalia, even though they're kind of similarly linked. But this particular study looked at type one herpes or the oral herpes. And so what they found was that they looked at 1,000 people who were dementia free. And this is an older group, so between the ages of 75 to 80 years old. And they looked at folks, people who had no dementia, and then followed them for about 10, 15 years. And they looked at patients who had dementia and what are some of the common things they saw in the blood workup of these patients. And again, when we say dementia, this study was looking at Alzheimer's disease, because Alzheimer's disease is one of the more debilitating forms of dementia. Where you pretty much lose your memory, unable to form new memories. And it's just not compatible with long life. And many people know this. So what they found was that those people who had history of type 1 herpes, we knew this because they looked at some of the antibodies in their blood, and they found those who had antibodies to herpes, showing that they were exposed to herpes in the past. They found that those who had this herpes antibodies had a markedly increased risk of forming dementia compared to their counterparts. So they found that out of the people who had herpes, 82% of those who had history of herpes 7% of those develop all-cause dementia. Dementia can also be caused by strokes as well, so there's a possibility that there was a link between that. And also 4% had Alzheimer's dementia, the most debilitating form of dementia. This is after the 15-year follow-up. So, you know, out of those, you know, people who had dementia over 11%, who had herpes, over 11% developed some form of dementia. So because of this, you know, it definitely opens the door for potential increased research in this area. This study was only 1,000 people long, and it focused on the older population from 70 to 85. You know, we know herpes is something that most people get in their younger days. So who knows if there's other things that may be influencing these numbers. But we are seeing that, you know, elderly people with herpes exposure, much higher risk of developing dementia from all causes, as opposed to those who do not. So just be careful, guys. You know, herpes is not a death sentence, but something you don't want if you can avoid it. And this is just another reason why you don't want it. So herpes and dementia, who would have thunk it? All right, sleep apnea. It's another thing that comes up in the doc today. And sleep apnea, something that many people suffer from and one of the most common illnesses or conditions out there. And sleep apnea is a condition where during sleep, you're actually having periods of poor ventilation, which can lower your oxygen levels in your blood, causing, you know, disruption of normal bodily functions. You know, sleep apnea is someone who also snores loudly, who gasps, pauses during deep breathing, or goes through periods of not breathing during sleep, where they wake up suddenly in the middle of the night and they don't really have a restful sleep. And this is, you know, someone who has sleep apnea typically is tired all day. They don't really feel well. And now we're seeing evidence that there is cognitive issues in patients who have severe forms of sleep apnea. Now, these findings were presented at the American Academy of Neurology at their annual meeting, or they will be presented at this meeting, but this was published in a recent journal. And they found that 4,200 people who were looked at participated in this study, and they found that they had a questionnaire filled out. They looked at sleep, memory, cognition, and decision-making abilities. And so those who were found to have sleep apnea, they compared them to those people who did not have sleep apnea, and they found that those who had sleep apnea were more likely to have cognitive problems, right? Almost 33% of them had cognitive problems, meaning problems with memory and other cognitive functions. So they again, this is a loose kind of survey, but, you know, I think it makes a lot of sense. If you're not sleeping well, you're not doing well, you're going to have problems with proper brain function. You're not going to be as sharp as you like to be. This is why a restful sleep is so important, and it can very well make a difference between a good day and a bad day. So if you're not sleeping well, you're having periods of sleep apnea, it can really affect your ability to function and have a normal kind of productive day. So guys, if you're not sleeping well and you're having issues with sleep apnea, I definitely would recommend you try some sleep aids. I'm a big fan of Breathe Right strips or similar products that open up the nasal passages a little bit more, help you breathe a little bit easier. You also can look into mouth guards to help you kind of keep your mouth in a position that allows for better air exchange. And lastly, there are surgical options as well if you have severe sleep apnea. It's also something that's very commonly seen in those who have obesity. But there are procedures you can have done surgically that can also open up the airways to help improve airflow and reduce some of these conditions that can happen. We know sleep apnea is associated with heart failure, high blood pressure, now cognitive issues, and the like. So sleep apnea is very dangerous. If you do have it, you want to definitely see your doctor to figure out ways to reduce its severity. And ultimately, something that's going to help you overcome this so you can have increased chance of long life. So, yeah, so sleep apnea, something you want to address if you do have it. All right, guys, so that's the end of the show. We had another segment too prepared, but it's kind of running out of time here. So we're going to go and wrap it up now and maybe bring to you the next episode. I want to thank you guys for listening to the show. We're we're just very thrilled with all the responses and the listeners. We want to make sure we continue to make you guys happy. So stay tuned. We're going to have a lot more shows coming forward. I'm your host, Dr. Barry. Thanks for listening. Please, guys, follow us on social media, Dr. Barry Health, on TikTok, at Dr. Barry MD on Instagram. And, of course, email Dr. Barry Health at gmail.com. So thanks for listening, guys. We will see you guys shortly. Keep listening and share And, you know, let your friends know about the show. We're big fans of new listeners, and we want to keep growing the platform. Thank you so much, guys. Until next time, peace.
Thank you for listening to the Health and Wellness Connection podcast and radio show. For more information on ways to get healthy, please check us out. www.anchor.fm/HW Connection. Here you can re-listen to the show, check out older shows, and even further support the show by becoming a subscriber to the podcast. Please check us out today. Again, that's anchor.fm/HW Connection. And also, don't forget to follow Dr. Barry on Instagram @DrBarryMD. Until next time, stay healthy.